Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Continuing our conversation with 90-year-old Navy veteran Russ Jenkins of Hollister, California. Anyone who was in the Pacific for as long as you were during World War II, Russ, seems to have some kind of memory of Tokyo Rose, the infamous Japanese radio propaganda artist who was voiced at different times by different women, but most famously by a Southern California native named Eva Toguri, who was convicted of treason after the war and spent a decade in prison. You remember hearing Tokyo Rose?
Oh, yeah, we got her all the time. When I was in the Aviation Repair Unit, it was the Aviation Repair Unit Navy 145 was the name of it, and she used to tune in and, you know, say, "This is a sailor's best friend, Tokyo Rose, bringing you the latest from the war news." She would talk about how the Japanese Navy and Air Force, they were all whipping the heck out of the Americans, you know. And, of course, it was all a big fat lie. And but she played some really good music, you know. She would give us some Frank Sinatra and some all the other, the big bands, you know, and that kind of stuff. I don't know where she got all that music. Maybe she took it over with her. You know, she got pardoned. She came back to the United States after, and she finally got pardoned.
What about VJ Day, victory over Japan? Where were you? How'd you find out?
I came back from the South Pacific February or March 1945. And I was assigned to overhaul and repair outfit at Alameda. And then I heard about this deal where you could get subsistence and quarters pay on shore patrol in Oakland. So I put in for it and I got it. A couple months later, I took the test for first class petty officer, and I passed that with flying colors with all the experience that I had in that aviation repair unit and elsewhere. So I was on shore patrol for a year. Well, it was all on Broadway, from 7th and Broadway to 22nd and Broadway. It was a bowling alley down at on 22nd and Broadway. And then there was a dance hall called the Uptown Ballroom on the left side of Broadway going down towards 22nd. It seemed like it was about three stories up because they didn't have an elevator and the stairway just seemed to go straight up. So we would go up there and check that out. I'd been up there a couple times. They had a nice little restaurant there. They had a 12-piece orchestra. And I mean, they were really good. And they had one of those lights that went around. Everything was real sort of dark in the ballroom, and the light went around and it had these little arrows of light that went out and hit people, you know, and whatever. And I got to looking in there and I said, all these women are in there dancing together, nothing but women. And I thought, now wait a minute, that don't seem right. So guess where I spent quite a bit of my liberty from then on?
On the dance floor.
Yeah, taking those women, tapping them on the shoulder and cutting in on the two of them dancing together. Of course, they were tickled to death to have us men people coming in and joining them, you know.
Well, and if my timeline's right, you would have been on shore patrol in Oakland for both VE Day and VJ Day. I imagine you saw some things.
The first one was VE Day, of course. They signed, gosh, it must have been 100 extra shore patrol guys, just temporary duty, temporary shore patrol. They give them an armband and a baton. So they are all supposed to go out and keep people from getting in trouble. But the next day, we found armbands and batons all over the city. Guys actually deserted their posts.
Swept up in the celebration, huh?
Yes, they did, yeah.
Can you describe that for us, what it looked like, what it sounded like, those celebrations?
It was absolutely fantastic. There was so much joy, you know, from the end of the war over in Europe. You know, I didn't mention, but my uncle, Thurman Jenkins, they call him Red because he was a redhead, he got captured during the Battle of the Bulge, and he was prisoner of war over there, and he had a lot of stories to tell.
Well, that made VE Day significant for your family, huh? I mean, he was probably liberated right before that.
Yes, he was, yeah. So it was a joyous time for his wife and family, you know, and all the rest of us too.
And what about VJ Day? Was it any crazier in the Bay Area then?
It was even crazier than VE Day was. Yeah, it was just the same thing all over again, you know, with the missing armbands and batons.
Did that mean something to you personally? Because here you got involved in this even in the shipyards before the Navy, pretty close to the beginning of the war, and now it's finally over. What did that mean to you?
Oh, that was a very joyous occasion, you know. It was hard to explain, you know, how great it was. I'll never forget it. You know, it was such a great day.
You know, you told us a story about Pappy Boyington and seeing the emotion he dealt with after the loss of one of his buddies. There's another famous name that you interacted with in your Navy career, and that was during your shore patrol days, I think, right? Did you have any idea you were working with a future astronaut?
Yeah, this was on my second hitch after I was assigned to duty in Corpus Christi, Texas, after leaving the Antietam, the aircraft carrier Antietam. I was assigned to shore patrol duty for a three-month period there in Corpus Christi, and my shore patrol officer was Captain John Glenn, the astronaut. I used to play AC-Deucy with him quite a bit. He was a great guy. I really liked him.
Well, I know we're about out of time, but 20 years in the Navy, you've told us a few of the things you did. Later on, you were flying admirals around as a flight engineer on a big R-6D. But 20 years in the Navy, what are you most proud of?
Well, yeah, I was proud of all of it, of course. But when I was stationed in Japan, I was able to bring my family over there. Place called Seijo Machi. It's where they had these movie studios where they made the Seventh Samurai movie. We shared a house with this Takahashi family, and they were really, really good to us. And when I first got my family over there, they had a coal strike on, and they manufactured their gas. In the evening, we'd have a little flame about an inch high on a stove burner, and the same way in the morning, just enough to fry an egg and what have you. And we almost froze to death. And so we finally got a diesel heater. Everybody in Japan and also in Philippines, I was stationed in the Philippines for 2 years. The women all had maids. Our maid's name was Shima. The kids all called her Mrs. Shima, and of course we started calling her Mrs. Shima too, even though she was a maid, you know. But I'd came home from work at Atsugi Air Base, and I was taking Mrs. Shima to her home after her shift working with us. She had that oil heater, which had a 5 gallon capacity, had ran out of diesel fuel, and she had gone out to the 55 gallon drum that we had out in the garage there and filled the 5 gallon tank up and brought it back and installed it on the stove and lit it. And in the meantime, she hadn't turned the valve off, which let the diesel fuel into the basket in the stove, and it was full of diesel fuel, and it had taken off. And when I got home, the flames were shooting about 50 feet out of the chimney of the house. And my wife and two kids were running in and out of the house. They would look up at see the flames, and then they'd run back. So I realized right away what probably happened. I ran in and turned it off, and it was white hot. The heater was just sitting there jumping up and down and rumbling. So I turned it off, and then it finally cooled down.
I do really want to know, and I'm sure our listeners want to know, what you're most proud of when it comes to your service, and why you think it's important for us to remember these times in our history and what happened.
One of the things that I'm most proud of is when I was stationed in Patuxent River, Maryland on my last hitch, and I was flying the Chief of Naval Operations and a bunch of other admirals around. Like, I had Admiral Anderson and Admiral Ollie Burke. 30-knot Burke, they called him. Those were really exciting times. They had to go into all these terrible places like Paris and Athens, Greece, and Barcelona, Spain, and often wondered why they had so much business in these places. But then we used to fly down to Lima, Peru quite a bit. One thing I didn't mention that I'd like to mention if I have time. In 1960, I was plane captain on this plane that was flying the Navy band around for President Eisenhower when the North American Alliance thing was going on down in South America. We had dropped the band off in Buenos Aires and went back by Tucson River, Maryland Naval Air Station to do a major maintenance check on the airplane. And this buddy of mine, Jim Cordell, who was shop chief and a good friend of mine, begged me to let him take the rest of the flight. So he was a flight engineer also. And so I let him take it, and he took the plane back to Buenos Aires, picked up the Navy band. We had two ex, they were APs, they call them. They were ex-enlisted pilots, but they had both been commissioned, and they were Lieutenant J.G.'s, and they were flying the airplane. They, like I said, picked the Navy band up in Buenos Aires, and they were going into Rio de Janeiro to drop it off for another engagement there that Eisenhower had. And they were holing at 5,000 feet over the inner harbor there, Sugarloaf Mountain. And Brazilian R-4D, old Goonie Bird, cut right in front of them. Instead of diving or pulling up, it swerved and it cut our plane right in two. Cut the tail of the plane off right in front of the tail. And there was two guys that were in that section that were still strapped in. And that plane from 5,000 feet, that tail section had enough aerodynamic stability to float down and plop in the water, and neither one of those guys had a scratch on them, but it killed everybody else. There was 18, it wasn't the full Navy band, of course, it's just a portion of it, 18 top-notch Navy band members that were killed, and crew, you know, and everybody on the plane except those two fellas.
So the guy that talked you out of being on that plane and said, I want your spot, and flew in what would have been your place, he died.
Yeah, and the two pilots, one of them's name was Hartshorn. He was from Wyoming, and his folks owned a big ranch up there, and they called him Doggy Hartshorn. And the other guy was a guy by the name of Jackson. But I, ever since then, I've had what they call survivor's guilt. I wake up at night sometime kicking Arlene, trying to get out of that plane, you know. It's really the one thing that has really affected me deeply.
I could see that, and I'm just, no one can understand that unless they've lived through it. But and I know I've got to wrap up here, but I want to thank you for serving our country, first of all, 20 years in the Navy, and that story is sobering in its own right. Every veteran that I have on this show, almost all of them, somebody says, you need to go talk to so-and-so. And it was a lady named Linda from here in Hollister that said, you need to talk to Mr. Jenkins, because she met you at the hospital when you were volunteering there. Things like that, where you're giving back, is part of the thinking behind that, because you realize your life could have ended 55 years ago?
Absolutely. They buried the two pilots and quite a few of the Navy band members at Arlington National Cemetery up in Washington. We had to go, we didn't have to, but we went up and attended those funerals, and that was so sad. Yeah, so that was something that has really affected me.
And it sounds like as much as it weighs on you, it's also spurred you to make a difference in a lot of other people's lives.
I try to.
Well, don't stop.
Okay.
Russ Jenkins, 90 years old. I'm so thankful we got to hear that last story, and I think we really heard his heart. It's always a privilege to meet these humble heroes from our greatest generation and share their stories with you. We're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.